It was just after 1 a.m. when the quiet inside the Armstrong home broke. Up on the third floor, 16-year-old A.J. Armstrong had been awake for hours, sick, restless, drifting between Netflix and the hope that sleep might finally catch him. He got up for one last trip to the bathroom. Nothing unusual, nothing alarming, just a teenager trying to settle into the night. But when AJ stepped back into the hallway, he heard it, his parents' bedroom door creaking open. A small sound, but enough to make him pause. Enough to pull his attention downstairs, where he assumed one of them was awake. Maybe he could ask for medicine. Maybe the night was still normal. He started down the stairs, and that's when everything changed. Two gunshots, sharp, close, then a third. The kind of sound that doesn't leave room for doubt. AJ turned and ran, back up the stairs, back toward the only place in the house that felt safe, his breath shaking, his voice barely above a whisper as he dialed 911 from inside his closet. Because someone, he said, was in the house. Someone masked. Someone who had just stepped into his parents' bedroom and pulled the trigger. By the time anyone reached them, it was too late. A family that looked perfect from the outside had already been split open in the dark. Their names were Antonio and Dawn Armstrong. Hello, and welcome to today's episode of Sleuthy Stories. If you're new here, this is the podcast where real-life mysteries unfold, one clue at a time. The audio for today's story has been pulled from my main YouTube channel and remastered for this podcast experience. If you'd like to see the visuals that accompany this case, head over to my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. But for now, sit back, listen closely, and let's unravel the mystery together. Thanks for being here. Hey there. Today's story isn't about strangers or monsters. It's about what happens when tension starts to grow in a place meant to feel safe. Because in some homes, love and pressure sit so close together, you can't tell where one ends and the other begins. Not until everything finally snaps. All right, here's how it all went down. That moment you heard earlier, those gunshots cutting through a quiet house, that's where everything ended. But to understand how it got there, we have to go back to who the Armstrongs were and the life they built long before that night. Houston, Texas. A city built on ambition, sprawling freeways, glittering skylines, and neighborhoods where success is both expected and displayed. It's a place where families chase opportunity, where hard work turns into legacy, and where people take pride in building something better than what they came from. And just southwest of downtown sits Bel Air. Quiet. Tree-lined. The kind of affluent pocket where people jog at dawn, kids bike home after school, and neighbors wave from manicured lawns. A community that prides itself on stability. Good schools, good homes, good families. But inside all that calm, there are corners that hold stories no one would ever expect. Because on this particular summer night in 2016, the air was thick and unmoving, warm in that way Houston nights always are, where even after midnight, the heat clings to everything. The streets were still. No late night traffic, no barking dogs, no movement at all on Palmetto Street. Just rows of comfortable homes settling into the quiet. And somewhere inside one of them, a door creaked open. A teenager froze in a hallway. And within seconds, the calm of Bel Air shattered forever. That's where the call came in, just after 1 a.m. on July 29th. What should have been another peaceful night in a peaceful neighborhood was about to become the start of an unimaginable tragedy. Just after 1:40 a.m., the quiet on Palmetto Street broke. A 16-year-old voice, shaky, breathless, barely above a whisper, came through to Houston's 911 line. It was A.J. Armstrong.
911, do you need medical, police, or fire?
I'm going to be police, as well as a transfer. He's whispering, advising just heard gunshots in the parachute.
And your name?
A.J.
Any medical attention needed?
I heard gunshots, so I don't even know.
In your parents' bedroom?
Yes. In your door's back. Only if there's crack.
Can you hear anything else?
He told the operator he'd heard gunshots from his parents' bedroom. Not one, not two, three sharp cracks in the middle of an otherwise still house. He said he'd run upstairs into his closet on the third floor trying to stay hidden. You can hear the panic in his words, the uncertainty, the strain, the way he kept pleading for the operator to hurry. At one point, she asked if anyone needed medical attention. AJ's answer was faint. I heard gunshots, so I don't really know. Then another detail, subtle but chilling. When she confirmed the shots came from his parents' room, AJ said, yes, and their door is cracked open. It's never cracked open. Moments later, he mentioned something else, a high-pitched ringing in his ears, a sound he couldn't explain, a sound the operator couldn't make sense of either. But what AJ focused on most was his little sister, Kara, just 12 years old. Her room sat dangerously close to the master bedroom, and he repeated it four separate times. My little sister's downstairs. Please make sure she's okay. The operator kept him talking. Weapon questions, location questions, layout questions. When she asked what the gun sounded like, AJ hesitated, saying he wasn't good with guns, then added, I know my dad has one. I think he keeps it in his drawer, right next to the bed. As sirens grew louder in the distance, AJ told her he could see lights outside. The operator instructed him to wait, to stay put until police signaled. They gave the signal. Then AJ ran from the third floor, down the steps, and woke Kara from a deep sleep. Together, the two children, terrified, barefoot, half awake, walked toward the front door to meet police. 16 minutes after AJ's call began, the door opened. Officers entered first, clearing the home, room by room, floor by floor, up the staircase, past the second floor landing, and finally, to the double doors of the master bedroom. What they found inside was brutal and immediate. Dawn Armstrong was already gone, shot twice in the head as she slept. Beside her, Antonio Armstrong Sr. was still alive, but barely. Breathing in short, shallow gasps, fighting for life he had almost no chance of keeping. The perfect family everyone thought they knew had just been shattered in the dark. To understand what police had just walked into, you have to know who Antonio and Dawn Armstrong were, and the kind of family they built long before that night. Antonio Armstrong Sr. was 42, a husband, a father, a mentor, and a man who'd climbed his way out of circumstances most wouldn't survive. Born in Houston's Kashmir Gardens, raised by a young mother who had him at just 15, and left without a father he never truly knew. Antonio learned early that life wouldn't hand him anything, but he worked anyway, pushed anyway, and that drive carried him farther than anyone expected. After graduating high school, he earned a scholarship to Texas A&M, became a standout linebacker, and delivered the performance of his college career in the 1994 Cotton Bowl, where he was named Defensive Player of the Game. The NFL came next, first the San Francisco 49ers, then the Dolphins and the Rams, followed by a stint in Canadian football before returning home to Houston. Retirement didn't slow him. He became a motivational speaker, built a fleet of first-class gyms, and stepped into ministry as a co-pastor at his mother's church. Antonio Sr. lived his life the same way he played the game, with discipline, commitment, and a fierce love for the people in his home. Don Armstrong was the heart of that home, warm, steady, and endlessly devoted to her children. She started as a visiting member of the Armstrongs' church, but her kindness, her calm spirit, and the way she cared for people made her impossible not to love. She became a Sunday school teacher, a trusted friend, and eventually Antonio's wife. When they met, Dawn was already a mother to her toddler son, Josh. Antonio embraced him immediately, so fully that Josh didn't learn he had been adopted until age 13. But in that house, there was no difference between the children. Josh, AJ, Kara, they were all his. They were all hers. Dawn was the kind of mother who documented everything. Photos, moments, milestones. She wanted her kids to know how deeply they were loved. AJ especially saw her as the ideal mother for him. Someone who understood him, guided him, grounded him. And he adored his father too. Antonio Sr. coached his football teams, showed up for every game, and celebrated AJ's talent on the field. Like father, like son, AJ excelled in every position he played. The Armstrongs lived in Bel Air, an affluent, tight-knit pocket of Houston, where safety was expected and opportunity was assumed. AJ attended the prestigious Kincaid School. Kara was 12, still at home, still wrapped in her family's routines and support. Josh, the eldest, was in college and living on his own nearby. This was a family that worked, a family that pushed through hard beginnings and built something stable, loving, and full of promise, which is what made the morning of July 29th so unthinkable. Because Dawn, the mother who held everyone together, was found shot twice in her own bed. And Antonio, the man who had overcome so much, lay beside her with a gunshot wound he would not survive. Everything they had built, everything they had risen from, was suddenly ripped apart in a single night. And while first responders tried to make sense of the scene, one question hung heavy in the air. How could something like this happen inside a home like theirs? In the hours that followed, police began piecing together a timeline, and what they uncovered would turn this from a tragic home invasion into a far more complicated investigation. Within minutes, first responders had secured the home, cleared every floor, and opened the double doors to the master bedroom. And what they saw inside would set the tone for everything that came next. Dawn was already gone. Two execution-style gunshots behind her right ear, a pillow placed over her head as if someone didn't want to face what they were doing. Antonio was barely clinging to life, gasping, fighting, unconscious but still breathing. He was rushed out of the home and taken straight to Memorial Hermann Hospital, where doctors prepared for a battle they knew they were likely to lose. Inside the bedroom, something else immediately caught detectives off guard. If this were a murder-suicide, as sometimes happens in cases of domestic conflict, then the weapon should have been within arm's reach, near Antonio, on the bed, on the floor, somewhere. But there was nothing. No gun. No shell casings near the victims. Just blood and silence. Detectives eliminated the murder-suicide theory within minutes. A few hours later, when homicide detectives arrived on scene, they began documenting everything from the ground up, literally. Before they even reached the bedroom, one detective noticed something on the carpet in the adjoining office, a single .22-caliber bullet resting among tiny pieces of debris. He mentally logged it and stepped into the bedroom. Dawn's body had already been removed. Antonio's blood-stained pillow still showed the violence of what had happened. But the room itself felt strangely undisturbed. No drawers pulled out. No signs of a struggle. Nothing knocked over. If someone had come to kill, they came with purpose. If someone had come to steal, nothing was missing. Detectives moved into the kitchen, And that's where the story shifted. Drawers stood open, as if someone had rifled through them in a hurry. On the counter sat a .22 caliber pistol and a note. A note with handwriting so messy it looked angry, overwritten multiple times, letters heavy and frantic. When detectives eventually deciphered it, the message sent a chill down the room. "I have been watching for a long time." And in the corner, another line, "Come get me." But seasoned investigators knew immediately something was wrong. Robbers don't leave handwritten notes. They don't take time to taunt. They don't stage scenes. They get in, get what they came for, and get out. So detectives began checking the rest of the house. Every door was deadlocked, every window intact, screens unmoved, blinds and curtains perfectly undisturbed, no forced entry, no signs anyone broke in, no indication of a stranger slipping through the night. And that's when the focus shifted. Not outward, but inward, inside the home, inside the family. "Separate the kids," Detective Dodson ordered. AJ, already sitting in the back of a police cruiser, watched as officers approached with brown paper bags. Gunshot residue testing. Routine, but telling. Kara, only 12, sobbed as officers slipped bags gently over her hands. She had just lost her parents. Now she was being processed like someone who might hold the key to why. Their grandmother, Miss Kay, arrived during this moment, and what she saw horrified her. Her grandchildren grieving, shaking, confused, and officers treating them as if the danger might have come from inside their own home. But based on the evidence so far, the staged kitchen, the cryptic note, the locked doors, the lack of forced entry, detectives already had a theory forming, and they weren't looking for someone on the outside. They were looking at someone already in the house. Within 11 minutes of examining the crime scene, AJ Armstrong became a person of significant interest. As dawn broke over Bel Air, detectives turned their attention to the people gathering outside, family members who had rushed to the scene the moment they heard what happened. Among them were Antonio's mother, Miss Kay, and Dawn's parents, the Whiteleys. Detectives needed clarity. They needed timelines. But most of all, they needed to understand the dynamics inside this home. So they began separating everyone, interviewing each person on their own. The first to speak was Josh, the Armstrongs' eldest son. Just 3 weeks earlier, he'd moved back home after losing his scholarship at Blinn College. He and AJ were sharing the third-floor loft until tension inside the home pushed Josh out again. Family members later said Josh hadn't been himself. Poor hygiene, withdrawn behavior, long stretches of time locked in the bathroom, talking to himself as if answering someone no one else could hear. Kara, the youngest, described it as him battling a demon. And there had been an argument, loud, emotional, explosive. One that ended with Antonio and Dawn telling Josh they were cutting him off financially and that he needed to leave. So he did. He moved into an apartment just around the corner from the family home. At the scene that morning, Josh looked rattled, frantic, unsteady, overwhelmed. When detectives asked where he'd been, he immediately said he had rushed over from his apartment as soon as AJ called him. His interview was short, factual, and when it ended, detectives photographed his hands and clothing. But given the evidence so far, the locked home, the note that appeared staged, the weapon found inside, Josh didn't fit the picture of someone who could have slipped in undetected. Detectives ruled him out as a person of interest and let him go. Next, they turned to the grandparents, not for suspicion, but for context. They needed to understand the emotional pulse of this family, the pressures beneath the surface. And that's when an unexpected shift happened. During her interview, one of the grandmothers made a startling, unprompted comment. She said that if AJ had been involved, it could be because he was struggling with drugs. Detectives weren't expecting that. It wasn't a theory they had raised. It wasn't a direction they had suggested. But it was enough to deepen their suspicions and widen the lens on AJ's behavior. With that new thread to pull, detectives circled back to AJ and Kara, interviewing them separately to preserve their accounts. AJ's story was consistent with his 911 call. Kara, he said, had been asleep the entire time. She didn't hear the gunshots. She didn't know anything had happened until he shook her awake and told her they needed to go downstairs. Standing outside the police cruiser, AJ recounted the night, his restlessness, the bathroom trip, the creaking door, the blasts from downstairs. Detectives listened closely, because every word mattered now. And just as they were working through his version of events, a new call came into 911, a frantic one, and it would change the tone of the investigation all over again.
Houston 911, you need medical, police, a fire? Excuse me? Okay, ma'am, please, I need for you to calm down for a little bit.
I'm at my boyfriend's apartment, and he just woke me up, and he ran over to his house because he lived like 2 minutes down the street because his brother got a call. He just got there and he called me and told me that his parents had been shot.
While detectives were still processing AJ's version of events, another call came into 911, this time from Hannah, Josh's girlfriend. She'd been asleep at Josh's apartment when he suddenly shook her awake. He told her an intruder was inside his parents' home, that AJ said their parents had been shot. And in a panic, Josh grabbed his shotgun from the closet and ran out the door. Hannah stayed behind, terrified and unsure what was unfolding just a mile away. And her 911 call added another layer of urgency, because the story Josh had just given her didn't match anything detectives were seeing inside the Armstrong home. Back at the station, investigators felt they had enough to proceed. AJ, only 16 years old, was handcuffed and taken into juvenile custody. 5 hours after the murders, an intake officer placed an orange visitor sticker on his shirt. A small label, but one that marked the beginning of an entirely new chapter in AJ Armstrong's life. He and Kara were tested for gunshot residue, swabs across AJ's hands, shirt, and sweatpants, as detectives prepared for the next phase, interrogating the only person inside the home awake during the shootings. At 6:53 a.m., AJ was brought before a juvenile judge. She read him his Miranda rights line by line, asked him to repeat them back, and then said, "What does this mean, Antonio?" AJ responded softly, "That, if I don't want to say anything, I don't have to." "That's correct," the judge said. It was a process required by Texas law, designed to ensure minors truly understand their rights. But minutes later, AJ waived those rights and agreed to speak with detectives. Seated across from two seasoned investigators, AJ began by describing his family. He called his father his best friend. But when asked about his mother, his tone shifted. A little distance, a little tension, the kind detectives don't overlook.
Ultimately, we're here. We got to, you know, we need to sit down and talk to you, right? Figure what happened today, what's been going on. How was your relationship with your parents in general?
It was a pretty good relationship.
Okay, you get along with your mom, get along with dad, no problems, no
issues.
Me and
dad were like really close. And then me and my mom, me, my brother, and my sister, like, had our, like, little issues with my mom, but it was never anything, like, serious. Like, it was just, like, family stuff. But we were all, like, really close, so it's okay.
And what about dad?
Dad was, like, the go-to for everything.
So. Any recent problems, any issues between you and him or anything like that?
No. Like, my dad's a pretty, like, chill guy. Okay. Likes to just talk things out, so any problem that we did have, we just talked.
Okay. And it's just, in the house, it's you, your mom.
My dad and my little sister.
What's mom's name?
Don Armstrong.
Okay, and dad's your...
Antonia.
Yeah, because you're a junior, correct? Right. Okay.
Yes, sir.
And then what's your sister's name?
Kara Armstrong.
K-A-Y-R-A?
Yeah.
Okay. And she's 12. And now you have an older brother that doesn't live there?
No, he does not. He just moved. He was going to Berlin, and he just moved back like 3 weeks ago. He's going to the Art Institute now, okay. And he lives in those apartments. Like, our house is here, and when you come out and make that left on Maple Ridge, he lives in those apartment complexes right there.
Okay, so right around the corner.
Yeah, it's right around the corner.
Okay, around his house. Yeah. Now, how is his relationship with everybody in the family?
I mean, he's really, like, me, him, and my dad are, like, a really close group. Like, we sit down and talk a lot. And then him and my mom are, like, identical people. Like, their personalities are the same, so they're close. And then me and him are just, like, have a really close brother relationship. And okay. Then my little sister, like, loves him.
As detectives pressed deeper, they began to feel a pattern that AJ's relationship with his parents, particularly with Dawn, may have been more complicated than the perfect family image suggested. They asked him to walk through the day leading up to the murders.
So we got to get down to what, you know, right. What kind of happened today. What, you know, we got questions, we got things we got to discuss. Yes. Some of them, they're not easy, but I mean, it's tough questions for us to ask, and it's tough questions for you to answer. So that being said, I mean, how did today kind of start?
Starting out from the morning.
Yeah, from the morning. What time did you get up?
So it was Friday. I didn't wake up, I don't know, until like 10, 11 o'clock. And I stayed in my room all day and just watched Netflix. My parents were like gone. Like, they were in and out of the house. My dad works from home a lot now, ever since he hurt his knee. So he's been working at home a lot. And my mom's in and out. She was mainly at our Bel Air gym, like, the whole day. And then she came back, and it was, like, she came back around 5, and it was me, my dad, and her. And then my mom and dad got dressed, and they went to one of my dad's friends' events that he had. So they were gone until, like, 8. And then when they got back, I went to go pick up my little sister from my grandmother's house, and we came back. We got back to the house at, like, 9 or 10. And then my little sister, I think she went straight to bed. My parents were laying in their bed. I don't know what they were doing. And I was just upstairs just watching Netflix still. And then it was like probably 1 or 2 and I was still up. And I was like, I turned off my TV. I was getting ready to go to bed. I went to the restroom. And when I came out, I heard the door open. And I haven't been feeling well like this whole day. And I thought it was my parents. So I like walked downstairs. So I was going to ask if I can get some medicine. And, like, as I was walking downstairs, that's when I heard the 2 gunshots go off. And I ran back upstairs. And then when I ran back upstairs, I heard somebody run out of my parents' room and, like, hit the door. And then I don't know how they got out. I don't know which. Because if they would have went out one of the doors, our alarm would have went off. So, like, my only guess is they had to have gone through a window because those don't go off with our alarm system. Like, it's not, like, connected. And after I ran back upstairs, I went into my closet. And that's when I called 911. And, like, I had the phone call. And when the cops showed up, the lady told me to go downstairs. And I was like, I have a little sister here. I need to get her. And I went to my sister's room. I woke her up. And then me and her both walked downstairs, like, let the cops know that it's not like it's just us. Like, we're not armed or anything like that. And they walked us outside. And that's when I immediately called my brother because he lives, like, right up the street. And him and my cousin, they both showed up. And I
explained. Who's your cousin?
Trenton. It's like, I saw the guy. Like, I feel like I should have done something, but... I mean,
well, did you physically see somebody? Or?
No, like, I saw him running. Like, I saw him running.
Okay, but then you would have seen him go out a window or out a door or something.
No, because when, like, you've been into the house, so it's like my parents' room's here, and then you'd have, like, it's when you come out of my parents' room, you go this way, and, like, this window, it's impossible. Like, that window's impossible to get out of.
Second floor too.
Yeah, second floor. So either he would have had to have gone, like, this way. And then gone over there by my sister's room, or he had to go downstairs and out through one of the first floor windows.
Okay. Okay. And then you said from you were upstairs and you heard a door.
Right.
Which was which door?
My parents' first door.
The first door in their
right.
room.
Right. Because normally my parents
which
like,
goes into the study.
Yes.
Okay. Now the person that you seen, I mean, what did he look like?
Is it
he or she or?
It was definitely a guy. It wasn't a girl. Okay. There wasn't like long hair or anything like that. I mean, they had it was like a mask, and like you could only see the eyes and the mouth. But he looked like a black guy. Mm-hmm. But I'm not like 100% positive. But I'm pretty sure it was an African American, and like I'd say like 6 feet maybe, okay. Somewhere around there. I couldn't give you like an age range. I didn't really like get to see his face or anything okay. like that.
But as AJ spoke, detectives noticed something troubling. He didn't cry. He didn't shake. His breathing never changed. He showed no visible distress, not even when they told him his mother had died. for investigators who had spent decades interviewing grieving families. That calmness was a red flag.
I hear everything you're saying.
Right.
And ultimately, you know, there are some issues. And I'd be lying to you if I didn't tell you there was some issues, and we kind of got to go over them, kind of get to the bottom of what's going on.
Exactly.
Ultimately, you know, you're out there, they swabbed your hand.
Right.
So ultimately, if you fired a gun, even if you wash your hands, it's going to show.
It's going to show. Right.
So if there was something more, something different that happened, this is kind of the time to talk about it. Regardless of what your relationship with your dad, if it's good or if it's not so good,
right.
You know, and you just don't feel comfortable talking about it. That's a whole separate issue.
Right.
You know, ultimately, we need to figure out what's going to happen, what happened today. So, again, if there's something different, this is the time. You know, and, hey, we're at, you know, the police department. Bad things have happened. And, you know, ultimately, this is kind of the time to talk about it.
Exactly.
You know, not later, not another time. Because, I mean, if anything, it's for them. This is, they don't have a word in this at this point in time. Okay. Mm-hmm. Last we heard, your dad is still in the hospital. Your mom didn't make it. Okay. So it's a bad thing. So you understand this, the seriousness of this. Okay. So that's why we need to know what happened.
Nothing different. Okay. That's the story.
Okay.
Another red flag came from the evidence itself. Detective Dotson had found a bullet in the office just off the master bedroom, but something about the angle bothered him. When he went back and really studied the scene, he looked up and saw it, a hole in the ceiling, a shot fired from above. Dotson's team followed that trajectory upstairs, where they found a corresponding hole in the floor. It had been hidden beneath a pile of socks. So during the interrogation, detectives asked AJ again, "Are you sure you haven't handled that gun?" This time, the certainty in AJ's voice faltered.
Does your dad own a gun?
Yes, he does.
One gun. Do you know what kind of gun it is?
I just know it's like a pistol. I think it's a 22, but I'm not like 100% positive. Like, I've only time I've ever like used it was when we went to the gun range and I was like 8 years old or something like that. But like, that's about it. And he has his case in one of his drawers, and like my dad, his drawers, the closet and under the bed is like off limits. So like, I've never gone in there or like seen it or anything like that, except for when he brings it out. So like, I don't know where he was keeping the gun at the time, but I know he keeps it in one of those three places.
Okay. So possibly a case in the drawer,
yeah,
or somewhere in the closet.
Right.
Okay. And that's where he keeps it. 22. You think it's a 22?
I think it's a 22.
What color is it?
Black.
Black. Is it a revolver, automatic? You know the difference between the two? Revolver, they have the cylinder that turns.
Oh, it's not a revolver. It's definitely
like a clip
a clip that goes in it. And then like, you like flip the safety and then you fire.
Okay. Ultimately, you know, when we're in the study that leads to your dad's room.
Right.
In there, when you look up, there's a bullet hole in the ceiling that comes from the loft, which
there's
is your bedroom.
There's a bullet hole in the ceiling.
Yeah, it comes through the floor from the loft, from your room upstairs.
Yeah.
Where your room
on
is.
The third floor.
Yeah.
There's a bullet hole in the ceiling.
There's a bullet hole in the study area that goes through, and you can see that it comes through because it pushes out
right
in the study area.
I've never seen that.
They use a trajectory rod too.
Yeah, and they use the trajectory. They have their rod. They use a rod. They put it in there, see
right
what the angle is.
Right.
And then on the floor, there's an actual bullet that was actually fired.
How long has that been there?
Well, that's why we're talking to you, because there's fresh sheetrock on the floor.
Right.
So, and that's kind of what we're getting at. There's things out there that we're trying to figure out how this has happened. You know, if there's two gunshots or four gunshots,
right?
How do we have one that's coming from the room upstairs, and then we've got other ones in there?
I can explain the gun from the room upstairs. It was like two, maybe three weeks ago. Like, me and one of my friends was just like playing around, and they were about to leave, and he was like, "Hey, well, not really. He was like me. I was like, "Hey, like, have you ever shot a gun before?" And they were like, "Nah, I've never done it." And I was like, "You want me to show you how to?" And like, I like went and checked the three places, and the gun was under my dad's bed. And I like laid my pillow and then like a blanket over it and a blanket under it, thinking like that would stop it. But I guess it did not stop it.
Yeah. Now, see, and that kind of goes back to what we were saying just a minute ago. You know, because a few minutes ago you said that you haven't seen it. You haven't shot it since you were a kid. And then now we kind of give you a little more. And then it's like, oh, wait a minute. So, you know,
I understand.
We don't want to keep getting deeper into this because there's more.
His story shifted. He admitted he had touched the gun more recently than he originally claimed. And that alone cracked open the possibility that he had easier access to the murder weapon than he wanted detectives to believe. The inconsistencies kept growing. AJ insisted he had nothing to do with the murders and even challenged the detectives, saying the gunshot residue test would prove it. There's nothing that will come back that it's on me.
If the gun was fired tonight, you know, again, the GSR test is going to show it.
Exactly.
So to say that you didn't, or it was fired.
I didn't fire it tonight.
No.
Last time I fired it was like 2-3 weeks ago, and I put a bullet. I guess my parents just never saw that. Because, I mean, that was a while ago.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
But ultimately, that's what I'm saying. It's, even if you wash your hands, whatever you have, it's still going to show.
Right.
Okay, so that's why I'm saying is, you know,
from like 3 weeks ago, you think?
No.
Oh, okay,
you fired a gun tonight. Whether it's in, you know, it's going to show that's there.
Exactly.
Ultimately, let's just say there was somebody else in the house with you. If that's the case, we need to know. Somebody we need to talk to. But again, we've already went through the, hey, I haven't seen it. I haven't fired it since I was little. And I don't know where he keeps it. We don't go there. It's off limits. So I don't go in there to, okay, I went in there. We were up there and we fired a gun and we put the towel, we put the blanket and all that stuff. So you kind of see how where we're going.
And that's like the only.
No, I know.
Yeah,
but I
understand where you're coming from.
I just don't want to be more like, wow, and now there's gunshot residue on his hands or on his clothing.
There won't be any gunshot residue on my hand or anything like that.
Or something like that.
Right.
Or let's say dad makes it. And dad say, hey, this is what's going on. This is what happened.
Right.
You know, it's just anything can happen at this point.
I understand. And I know I didn't personally touch the gun. Like, I know there's no gun residue on my hand or on my clothes or anything like that. So I know it has nothing to do with me. I just don't understand. I don't understand how he got out or even how he got in.
And ultimately, you know, the gun is still in the house.
Right.
Okay. So it's on the kitchen counter. So it's one of those things where if somebody's running out of the house, there's no time to
put it on the kitchen counter.
Put it on the counter, and there's even like a little paper where there's some scribbling on it. So there's not really a lot of time if you're running out of the house, jumping out of a window to go put the gun there and then write a note. So you see, that's why when you say, hey, he ran out, jumped out of a window, we didn't go out of a door. Because if he doesn't know you're there or whatever it might be.
I'm assuming that's what it is. I was on the third floor.
No,
I don't know what happened.
Well, the doors were all locked.
Right.
Even when we got there, the doors were locked.
Exactly.
You had to unlock the door to come out.
My dad locked all the doors.
You had to unlock the door to get out. The back door's locked. Everything's locked.
Right.
So if somebody's in the house, it's just you and your sister, where are they at?
Exactly.
You know, and if they're running out and they're jumping out of a window, I mean, there's no blinds messed up. There's nothing that shows somebody went out of a window. And the gun is placed on the counter with a paper and a pen with some scribbling. There's the time.
Yeah, I understand.
If you're rushing out.
Doesn't seem right.
I mean, that's one of those.
I don't know like exactly what happened from the time when he came out of the room to when he left, because like as soon as I saw him, I was gone upstairs. So I don't know exactly what happened with him. I'm just saying I'm assuming that's how he got out, because I don't know any other way to get out of our house.
But detectives knew something AJ didn't. When a gun fires, blowback particles hit the shooter's hands and clothing. Tiny metallic fragments that don't disappear just because someone wipes their palms or changes their shirt. And they had more evidence. Burn marks on the carpet outside his parents' bedroom. Small, but distinct. When investigators leaned in, the smell of accelerants hit them. Gasoline or rubbing alcohol. Something had been burned, or someone had tried to start a fire.
Okay, so I know you guys saw the black little thing on the carpet when you walk upstairs. Yeah, that, I was like playing with matches and I dropped it. I dropped one and didn't realize it, and I just walked away. And then like the carpet set on fire, and then my dad came and confronted me about it, and I was like, I don't know, because I was like, it's stupid that I was playing with matches. I can't just admit. So I was like, I don't know. I had nothing to do with it. And like, I don't know, like my dad like t- took that personally. He was like, you like straight up like to my face. Like, I told him the next day what actually happened, and he was like, you like straight up like to my face, just like lied to me. And like that, like it, like it hit home with my dad. But I mean, like that day, like we talked about, like we've been fine. Like me and my dad, whenever we do have problems, like we sit down and we talk about it and we solve it. Yeah. Like then.
How long ago was the carpet burned?
That was Tuesday.
Okay. Alright. What'd y'all put it out with? What'd y'all put it out with?
That blue pillow that's right there.
Put out the pillow?
Yeah.
Did you spill anything on the floor before?
No, I didn't spill anything on the floor. That's the thing that was like confusing to me. I didn't spill anything on the floor.
What's the bottle of rubbing alcohol that's empty in your bedroom?
I don't know.
I'm just asking because the other investigator that was out there says that the floor right there smells like accelerant, which is like some type of
gas or something like that. Yeah, right. Because me and my dad, when like it happened, we both said that it like smelled like gas somewhere, and we didn't know where it was coming from.
Yeah,
but like we don't have any gas at the house. So.
Well, I mean, it could be rubbing alcohol. That's why I'm asking, because that easily lights.
I know that rubbing alcohol was from my dad's room, and I took it from his room.
What'd you take it for?
Because I needed it.
Then detectives leaned on psychology. They asked about his relationship with his father. AJ said there were no issues, but detectives pushed back, revealing that his grandmother had suggested otherwise. Stress, arguments, pressure building inside the household. And when they confronted AJ with pieces of the 911 call, they noticed another shift. At one point during that call, AJ whispered, "It's all my fault." Detectives took that as a potential admission.
Okay. When you called 911, you were very calm on the phone. Your parents had both been shot, and you're very calm on the phone. That's not normal.
You can ask the police that have been, like, I'm just like, I was crying, but I can't, like, my brother calmed me down, and I was bawling, crying coming out of the house.
I understand that. I'm talking about when you called 911 when this incident happened. I'm not talking about down afterwards, several minutes after your brother showed up.
So I didn't really know what happened. I didn't know if, like, they were actually dead. I didn't know if, like, I genuinely just didn't know what happened. And, like, I've tried to, like, explain that I had nothing to do with this. And I guess I'm just going to have to wait till, like, all the tests come back to prove that I had nothing to do with this.
But you knew something bad happened.
Yeah. But I had nothing to do with it. And I guess, like, when the test, like, all the tests are going to have to come back and prove that AJ had nothing to do with this. And, like, that's how it's going to go. Because, like, clearly my story isn't matching up with what was shown. So I'm just going to have to, we're just going to have to wait till till everything comes back to show that I didn't do it.
It's not even so much the tests. Because the thing is, it's not even so much the test.
So what happens when the tests come back and I had nothing to do with it?
But it's not just the test.
No, I'm just asking.
What happens then? The tests don't answer all the questions.
But when you figure out I don't have gunpowder residue on my hand,
What if you had gloves on? What I'm telling you is the tests can help us and they cannot help us. But ultimately, we have issues that we can't get around.
I honestly don't know what else to say, so we might as well just end this interview.
So was there somebody else in the house?
I don't personally understand it either, because I know, like, personally with me, I had nothing to do with it, so it doesn't make sense to me either.
And then to kind of forward to your 911, I mean, I called our dispatcher, and I asked, you know, hey, we need to listen to the tape where you called 911.
Right.
And about 7 minutes into it, he said, this is your fault. Like, this is your fault. So, I mean, something like that.
No, the this is my fault was at the point where, like, when I saw and I didn't do anything about it. That's what I was saying. Because, like, when I came outside.
You said it's all my fault. It's all my fault.
Well, I mean, I felt like I could have done something.
Yeah, but that's a little bit different than it's all my fault.
That's the exact same thing I said when I walked outside to the police.
They reminded him that he never mentioned an intruder during the entire 16 minutes he was on the phone. Not once. Not even when asked what he heard. If he truly believed someone masked had killed his parents, why didn't he say it sooner? Detectives pressed, pushed, looked for cracks, but AJ held firm. I understand the situation does not look good at all for me. I didn't do it, and I didn't get anyone to do it. Despite his insistence, investigators moved forward. A.J. Armstrong, 16 years old, was formally charged as a juvenile with capital murder and taken to the Harris County Juvenile Detention Center. And while he was being questioned downtown, the rest of the family gathered at Memorial Hermann Hospital, hoping for a miracle that wasn't coming. Antonio Armstrong Sr. never regained consciousness. Hours after arriving, he died from his injuries. And with his death, the investigation's urgency snapped into focus. This wasn't just a shooting. This was a double homicide. And detectives now had two victims and one primary suspect. 8 days after the murders, Houston gathered to grieve. Nearly 3,000 people filled Windsor Village Church, so many that the service had to be moved there because the Armstrongs' home church simply couldn't hold the crowd. Antonio and Dawn Armstrong weren't just loved. They were revered. Mentors, leaders, pillars in their community. And for the first time since his arrest, AJ was allowed to attend. Plainclothes officers escorted him in quietly, his handcuffed hands hidden beneath a jacket. He sat in the front row, a 16-year-old who had lost both parents and now faced the possibility of losing his freedom too. After the service ended, AJ was escorted straight back to juvenile detention. Meanwhile, detectives weren't attending memorials. They were trying to unravel the crime that had shattered this family. The more they examined the evidence, the more they became convinced of one thing. The shooter knew this home, knew its layout, knew its routines, knew where the parents slept, where the children slept, and how to move through the house without waking anyone. This wasn't random. This was intimate. But if AJ wasn't the killer, who else had that kind of access? As investigators waited for lab reports, they pursued every angle. Family phone records, timelines, behavior patterns. But one test held their focus. Gunshot residue. If AJ had fired the weapon, there should be microscopic metallic particles on his hands, clothing, or skin. The swabs came back. Negative. For both AJ and Kara. Detectives were stunned. AJ had insisted, again and again, "There's nothing that will come back that it's on me." And he was right. The negative result forced detectives to reconsider everything. Was AJ telling the truth? Had someone else pulled the trigger? Had he changed clothes? Had an accomplice entered and exited through a place they hadn't discovered? But then came a new piece of information. Something detectives hadn't accounted for. The ammunition used in the murders was .22 caliber, and .22 caliber rounds often don't leave detectable GSR. Suddenly, the test results weren't exonerating. They were simply inconclusive. If AJ fired the gun, the test wouldn't necessarily catch it. And if he didn't, they still couldn't rule him out. Detectives shifted their focus to the weapon and the note found in the kitchen. Surely, if AJ had handled the gun recently, and he admitted firing it just weeks earlier, his fingerprints should be somewhere on it. But they weren't. His prints weren't on the firearm, the notepad, the pen, or the handwritten note. Nothing. Not a single smudge. For investigators, that was troubling. Guns don't just wipe themselves clean. And the absence of AJ's fingerprints didn't align with his claim of having used it just 3 weeks before. If someone had wiped the gun, who and why? Detectives then combed through the house, looking for any sign of cleanup. Towels, soap residue, water droplets, gloves, anything. But there was nothing. No gloves. No evidence of someone washing their hands. No sign of someone scrubbing themselves clean after firing a weapon. No physical trace of AJ's involvement, which left detectives with a baffling contradiction. The weapon was inside the house. The alarm was armed. Every window was locked. Every door deadbolted. no forced entry, no footprints, no broken screens, and yet no physical evidence tying AJ to the scene. Every lead pointed in one direction, and every piece of physical evidence refused to confirm it. And still, detectives couldn't answer the question quietly forming beneath everything else. Why? What motive could drive a 16-year-old, by all public accounts, a grounded, supported, and loved teenager, to kill the very people who raised him? Investigators weren't just searching for evidence anymore. They were searching for clarity, for a story that made sense. But at this point in the investigation, nothing did. 12 days after the murders, detectives were still trying to make sense of the Armstrong case when something unexpected happened. A break-in at one of the Armstrong family gyms. Two masked intruders, caught on surveillance, smashed a window, slipped inside, and began rummaging through drawers like they were searching for something specific. They passed by big-screen TVs, ignored expensive equipment, never touched the registers. They walked out with one thing, a single computer. And detectives had to ask themselves, was this connected? Were these the same intruders AJ claimed had been inside his home? Or was someone trying to retrieve something that could tie back to the murders? But after combing through the footage and weighing the timing, detectives landed on a different conclusion. This wasn't strategic. It was opportunistic. Someone saw a high-profile tragedy, knew the gyms would be understaffed, and took advantage. It was unsettling, but it didn't move the Armstrong investigation forward. And so, detectives returned to the only place the evidence had ever consistently pointed, back to AJ. With no fingerprints, no GSR, and no forced entry, investigators turned to something they believed would be definitive: blood spatter. If AJ fired a weapon at close range, especially in a confined bedroom, there should be trace amounts of blood somewhere on his clothing or shoes. So they sent everything he'd been wearing that night to the lab: his gray t-shirt, his sweatpants, his flip-flops, and the results came back negative. All of it. Every single item. Another dead end. Detectives were now staring at a crime that looked meticulously executed. But by whom? And how? With no motive, no physical evidence, no signs of cleanup, and no disruption to the home's alarm system. Something wasn't adding up. So investigators went back to the beginning, to AJ's own words, to the 16-minute 911 call they now suspected held more truth and more lies than they first realized. When detectives re-examined the call, the inconsistencies were impossible to ignore. First, AJ never mentioned a masked intruder. Not once. Not until 5 hours later, when speaking to detectives. Second, when the operator asked whether anyone needed medical help, AJ didn't say, "My parents." He said, twice, "I don't know." But detectives argued, he did know. Gunshots had just gone off in their bedroom. Neither parent emerged. And Antonio was still alive when paramedics finally reached him, gasping for air, fighting for minutes he didn't have. To detectives, AJ's hesitation wasn't confusion. It was delay. A delay that prevented his father from contradicting his story, if he survived. Third, the moment AJ was asked about his father's gun, he suddenly pretended not to know where it was kept. God, where does he keep his gun? But AJ had already admitted to detectives that he fired that same gun just weeks earlier. That contradiction didn't slip past investigators. It was a red flag, not just of deceit, but of intentional distancing. Fourth, that high-pitched ringing AJ described in his ears. Detectives recognized it immediately. Tinnitus. The kind you get when a firearm is discharged in a small room with no ear protection. And AJ was alone on the call. No one told him to say that. Then came the phrase that stopped detectives cold. How did you get into my house? To them, it sounded like panic, not at an intruder, but at realizing he'd forgotten something. That the house was locked. That the alarm system was armed. That no one could have come in or out without triggering it. And AJ had already admitted he disarmed the alarm for police. Put together, the 911 call didn't just raise questions. It shifted the entire investigation. Just as detectives were deepening their analysis, someone unexpected walked into the precinct. Maxine Adams. She claimed she had information about Antonio Sr., rumors of a prostitution ring, death threats, a sudden change to his life insurance policy. She suggested her husband, Cecil, a known associate of Antonio, might have enemies, might even be connected to the shooting. Detectives took it seriously, at first. But Maxine's story began to unravel within minutes. She said she'd hired a private investigator to look into her husband, but couldn't remember his name. She couldn't provide proof of the alleged ring. Her claims about death threats had no source. And not one detail she shared could be verified. To detectives, it felt less like evidence and more like a distraction. And so the investigation returned, once again, to the 911 call, to the house, and to the mechanics of what actually happened in those early morning hours. But to understand the next major shift, detectives needed one last piece, the Armstrong home's alarm system records. Because if they could see exactly when the system armed, when it disarmed, and who entered the code, they might finally uncover the timeline they couldn't see. While detectives were busy pulling apart AJ's 911 call, another piece of the puzzle was finally ready, the Armstrong family's alarm system logs. And what those logs showed didn't just contradict AJ's story, they rewrote the entire timeline. The Armstrong home had two motion sensors, one on the first floor and one on the second, right outside Antonio and Dawn's bedroom. And to detectives, that meant something simple. If an intruder entered from the ground floor, the first floor sensor would trigger first, then the second floor. That's the only order that made sense. But here's what actually happened. At 9:52 p.m., the alarm is armed for the night. AJ said Kara set it before bed. At 10:39 p.m., the second floor motion sensor becomes inactive. No movement after that. None recorded. Around 1 a.m., AJ claims he hears gunshots after using the bathroom. But the alarm says something very different. At 1:09 a.m., the second floor motion sensor activates, right outside his parents' door. At 1:25 a.m., the first floor sensor triggers. At 1:56 a.m., the alarm is disarmed using a key fob. The exact moment AJ runs downstairs with Kara to meet police, and detectives locked onto one glaring discrepancy. If a masked intruder entered from the outside, the first floor sensor should have triggered first, not last. To detectives, the order of the sensors meant one thing. There was no intruder. The person who killed Antonio and Dawn was already inside the house. And that theory pointed them straight back to AJ. But detectives still needed something they didn't yet have. A motive. Not a perfect one. Just something that made sense of the tension building inside this home. 8 months after the murders, AJ's case shifted from juvenile court to adult court. After spending nearly a year in detention, he was released on bond. Ankle monitor blinking, public attention swirling, and a plea of not guilty. But detectives were just getting started. Because while they waited for forensic evidence, they finally got access to something that would reshape the emotional spine of this case, AJ's text messages. And what they found wasn't a smoking gun, but a slow burn. Detectives extracted months' worth of messages, the kind teenagers delete, rewrite, send quickly, or hope no one sees. And through those texts, a different picture of the Armstrong family emerged. Not the polished, public-perfect family everyone saw in church, but a household struggling with a son who was drifting further and further out of reach. October 2015. Dawn's messages were full of encouragement. Son, you can do this. We believe in you. January 2016. The tone changed. You're lying to us. February. You're starting to lie more. Then months of frustration, missed assignments, skipped practices, slipping grades, and AJ shrugging off every attempt to discipline him. The more detectives read, the clearer the theme became. AJ lied. A lot. Even when he didn't need to. And Dawn, the disciplinarian, the parent who pushed him to do better, was often the one confronting him. 3 months before the murders, another incident surfaced. One detective's believed revealed something deeper. Kate, AJ's girlfriend, texted him after midnight asking for a ride from a party. AJ agreed, even though he wasn't allowed to leave the house. He drove out anyway. Picked her up at 1:09 a.m. Came home unnoticed, or so he thought. The next morning, Dawn caught him. She confronted him, checked the alarm logs, challenged him, and AJ lied, over and over, inventing elaborate explanations while secretly texting Kate to keep the story straight. To detectives, it wasn't about a teenager sneaking out. It was about a teenager willing to lie in the face of proof, to double down, manipulate, and spin. The same traits they saw in the interrogation room. Then came a detail that stopped detectives cold. 2 days before the murders, a burn mark appeared on the carpet at the top of the stairs just feet from his parents' bedroom. AJ casually told detectives he lit a match and walked away. He blamed his sister. He said his parents laughed it off. But Dawn didn't laugh. In fact, she confided in Josh, distraught and deeply troubled. The burn mark smelled of accelerant. And detectives began asking a grim question. Was this an accident? Or was it a failed attempt to set the house on fire while his parents slept? No single text message proved motive. No single confrontation drew a straight line to murder. But detectives saw something else. A long pattern of tension. A widening rift between AJ and his parents. And a teenager who felt boxed in, corrected, restricted, and held accountable, more than he wanted to be. In their view, it wasn't hate. It wasn't rage. It wasn't a sudden explosion. To them, it was adolescent resentment mixed with mounting consequences and a willingness to lie his way through anything, even the unimaginable. Up until this point, detectives were following threads, leads, clues, contradictions, dead ends. They were gathering pieces. But now, they were ready to put those pieces together. And this is where the investigation stopped, and the state's case began. Because prosecutors believed they finally understood not just who committed the murders, but how the night unfolded, minute by minute. And according to them, the truth lived in the timeline. It begins on July 28th, just before 10 p.m. Kara says goodnight to her parents, and arms the house alarm at 9:52 p.m., every door and window locked, every motion sensor active. Everyone heads upstairs. And at 10:39 p.m., the second floor motion sensor outside Antonio and Dawn's bedroom goes still. No movement. No intruders. No footsteps. Just silence. AJ is in his third floor room, texting his girlfriend until around midnight. Nothing unusual yet. But prosecutors say everything changes after 1 a.m. 1:02 a.m. AJ stops using his phone. 1:04 a.m. He plugs it in. 1:08 a.m. He unplugs it, but doesn't unlock it. And then, 1:09 a.m. The second floor motion sensor activates. Not the first floor one. Not the one an intruder would trip. This one. Right outside his parents' bedroom. Prosecutors say this was the moment AJ left his room, phone in hand, walking down the stairs in the dark, not using the flashlight, too bright, too obvious. Just the glow of the locked screen flickering on and off as he made his way toward their room. They believe he stood in the doorway for a moment, just long enough to steady his breath. Then he stepped inside. Dawn and Antonio were both asleep, lying on their left sides. They never saw him coming. Prosecutors say AJ raised his father's .22 caliber gun and fired twice into his mother's head, one bullet tearing through her earlobe before entering her skull. She died instantly. The noise jolted Antonio awake. He lifted his head and was met with the third shot. He collapsed, but he wasn't gone. He was still breathing, still fighting. And this is the part of the state's theory that still chills people, because prosecutors say AJ stood at the foot of the bed watching his father gasp for life. Then he pulled a pillow from behind Dawn's body and placed it over his mother's head, walked around the bed, knelt in front of his father, and placed a pillow over his face, too, covering them, quieting the room. And then he walked away. At 1:25 a.m., 16 minutes after that upstairs motion trigger, the first floor sensor finally activates. Prosecutors say this was AJ heading to the kitchen, not in shock, not running for help, but staging a break-in. He places the murder weapon on the counter, rummages through drawers, rips a page from a notepad, writes an eerie message, "I have been watching for a long time," crosses it out, rewrites it, leaves it behind. A staged intruder, a staged motive, a staged escape. And then, 15 minutes of nothing. No calls, no screams, no attempt to help his father, who was still alive. Just silence. Until 1:40 a.m., when AJ finally dialed 911, telling the operator he'd just heard gunshots. But prosecutors believed he was lying. And this is the part prosecutors believed would eventually shape their case. For 31 minutes, from 1:09 a.m. to 1:40 a.m., AJ was the only person awake and moving inside that house. His phone activity stopped. The alarm sensors lined up with his movements. Every digital breadcrumb matched the state's timeline perfectly. A puzzle that fit too cleanly to be coincidence. "What was he doing for those 31 minutes?" the prosecution asked. They already knew their answer. When detectives analyzed the earlier carpet burn outside his parents' bedroom, they discovered something else. A bottle filled not with rubbing alcohol, but gasoline. And inside AJ's iPad, in the hours following that incident, they found a web search. How can a car be rigged to explode when started? To prosecutors, this wasn't mischief. It was escalation. A dangerous shift in thinking. A willingness to solve problems permanently. And then the hole in AJ's bedroom floor. The bullet. The debris. The fabric fibers. Prosecutors believed that AJ test-fired the .22 that very afternoon, the same day his sister was gone, his father was working, and he was home alone. They said he fired through a comforter and pillow to muffle the sound, to see how loud it would be, to test whether Kara would wake up in the next room before he tried it for real. When confronted, AJ changed his story, from firing the gun at age 8 to firing it maybe this week. It wasn't one clue. It wasn't one contradiction. It wasn't one piece of evidence. It was the timeline, the alarm system, the digital footprints, the behavior on the 911 call, the earlier fire attempt, the test shot, the 31 minutes unaccounted for. And prosecutors believed they finally understood not just who pulled the trigger, but how the night unfolded, step by step. And with that, the case moved out of the hands of detectives and into the courtroom. Because what happened next, no one in Houston was prepared for. The first trial of AJ Armstrong. When this case finally reached a courtroom, no one expected how long it would take or how divided the search for truth would become. Because what happened next wasn't just one trial. It was three. 2 years and 8 months after the murders, the state of Texas brought A.J. Armstrong to trial. And from day one, prosecutors faced a problem. No DNA, no fingerprints, no blood spatter, no confession. Their case rested on what they believed was their strongest evidence, the Armstrongs' alarm system. A digital record, they said, proved the killer was already inside the home. The defense went in a different direction. They pointed to someone else with access to the house, someone struggling with mental health, someone who knew where the gun was kept, Josh Armstrong. They challenged the alarm's reliability. They explained the hole in AJ's floor as nothing more than a teenager showing off a gun to a friend. And when prosecutors asked who that friend was, AJ's story shifted. The friend left, or maybe the friend wasn't there. Maybe the shot was earlier. The jury couldn't agree. 8 believed AJ was guilty. 4 believed he wasn't. The judge declared a mistrial. A case this divided was far from over. 3 months later, prosecutors prepared to retry the case. And this time, they had help from a source no one expected, Cellebrite. The phone extraction software rolled out a major update, unlocking a new level of insight into iPhone usage. Now investigators could see when AJ's phone was locked or unlocked, when it was plugged in or unplugged, when the screen lit up, when apps were opened, and when activity stopped altogether. 2 independent timelines, the alarm system and the iPhone, suddenly snapped together like puzzle pieces. For prosecutors, this meant something simple. The second trial would be stronger than the first. This time, the state leaned fully into premeditation. They brought in the attempted arson, the test shot through the comforter, the shifting stories, the alarm evidence, the iPad search. How can a car be rigged to explode when started? And they argued that AJ had been planning this for days. The defense countered with the same theory. Josh, cut off financially, asked to leave the house, battling severe mental health episodes. This time, the judge allowed Josh's medical records. Inside them, Josh had said he witnessed the murders. The defense seized on that. Prosecutors reframed it. They argued he saw his parents taken away on stretchers, not the shooting itself, and that his psychosis worsened after the trauma of their deaths. They pointed out no hostile messages between Josh and his parents, no evidence of conflict, and the fact that no one cuts off a child financially while handing them the keys to a Mustang. Once again, the jury split. But this time, the split reversed. 8 said AJ was not guilty. 4 said he was. Another mistrial. And now the case was no longer just about evidence. It was becoming a question no jury could answer. What do you do when the truth sits on a knife's edge? The answer arrived 7 years after the murders. Detective Rossi, a bloodstain pattern expert, asked to review the physical evidence herself. She began with the pillows that covered Antonio and Dawn's faces. Then she saw AJ's clothing, tagged with the orange visitor badge placed on him during his intake interview. And underneath that badge, she saw it. Reddish brown, staining the size of a dime. A presumptive test hit positive for blood. When the DNA results returned, they were unequivocal. The blood belonged to Antonio Armstrong Sr. The question wasn't how it got there. The question was how it went unnoticed for 7 years. Prosecutors believed they knew. They argued that when Antonio was shot, he wasn't bleeding outward yet. There was no spatter on the bedding. But as he struggled to breathe, lungs filling, pressure mounting, he expelled fine micro droplets of blood into the air, and prosecutors said those droplets landed on AJ when he placed a pillow over his father's face. The visitor badge, they argued, sealed those droplets in place. The third trial would not be like the first two. This time, prosecutors didn't just describe the crime scene. They rebuilt it. A full-scale replica of the Armstrongs' bedroom was constructed inside the courtroom. The staircase, the bed, two mannequins lying on their left sides. They walked the jury through the timeline. The movements, the alarm triggers, the phone activity, the contradictions, the fire attempt, the test shot. And now, the blood. Defense attorneys said the blood was contamination, transferred through handling, a fluke. The jury didn't agree. After 11 days of testimony and more than 40 hours of deliberation, they returned with a unanimous verdict. Guilty. A.J. Armstrong was convicted of capital murder on August 15, 2023. His appeal was denied. He will be eligible for parole after 40 years. The verdict divided the courtroom. Prosecutors felt vindicated. The Armstrong family, still united behind A.J., felt devastated. Ms. Kay said justice had not been served. Others said the wrong son was on trial. But when prosecutors spoke with the jurors, they were surprised. It wasn't the new blood evidence that convinced them. It was AJ's own words, the inconsistencies, the lies on the 911 call, the contradictions in the interrogation. And one more thing, Josh, the brother the defense pointed to, was the first person AJ called after 911. Josh rushed to the home, asked what happened, listened to AJ's story, and then told him the same thing detectives had been saying for 7 years. Your story makes no sense. By the time the verdict was read, 7 years had passed. But long before that day, this family had already been fractured in ways a courtroom could never repair. It's almost unbelievable how a story can hold together at midnight and then collapse by morning. AJ's version of events should have worked, in theory. A masked intruder, a locked house, a sleeping family. It's the kind of story detectives hear all the time. But the thing about stories is, they don't get to bend physics. And the alarm system didn't care about age, image, or the fact that his father played in the NFL. It simply recorded movement. And every movement pointed inward. Every single motion that system captured pointed in one direction, the inside of the house. And that's when everything started to tilt. The 911 call that was supposed to paint him as terrified, it painted him as rehearsed, focused on his sister's safety, but not the two people lying shot in the next room. The interrogation that should have cleared him, it exposed him, not through confession, but through confidence. That untouchable teenage certainty you only see in someone who believes they're too clever to get caught. And then there was the part no one ever mentions, the part between the evidence. The irony is, AJ had everything. A Mustang, private school, the future already paved for him. Parents who gave him every opportunity except the one he didn't want. Accountability. And accountability was the one thing he'd do anything to avoid. Kate knew that about him. She knew the lies. She stayed anyway. She married him between trials. She had his daughter. She built a future with a man whose past was still being litigated in real time. And in the end, she became one more person left to rebuild a life around his decisions. And then came the twist no one expected. Blood. On the shirt he wore that night. Preserved by pure accident. Under a visitor sticker. 7 years of trials, two hung juries, experts, theories, reconstructions, and the answer was sitting under a square of adhesive, no bigger than a name tag. But the jurors didn't convict AJ because of science. They convicted him because of his own words, the shifts, the versions, the lies that couldn't survive a bright room and a straight question. That's the thing about lies. They sound different under fluorescent lights. And once the truth finally took form, it didn't matter how many versions AJ rehearsed. Only one version fit the evidence. And it wasn't his. That's the story of Dawn and Antonio Armstrong. Thank you so much for being here with me. If you want more stories like this, don't forget to follow the podcast. Until next time, stay safe. I'll see you in the next one. That wraps up this episode of Sleuthy Stories. Thanks for joining me as we uncover the twists and turns of real-life cases. If you enjoyed the show, don't forget to follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you have a moment, please leave a rating. It really helps more true crime fans find us. Want to see the visuals that go with today's case? You can find the full video version on my YouTube channel, Sleuthy Lucy. Check the link in the description. I'll be back soon with another case. But until then, keep your wits sharp and your curiosity sharper.